You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline on this beautiful summer stormy day. And we're having, what did you call it, Mom? A gully washer?
It's a gully washer, yes.
Where'd you get that term?
Oh, I don't know. I was married to a farmer for a lot of years, you know.
Ah, yeah. So we braved the rain, and here we are in our solar-powered radio station.
Right.
That's probably not getting too much solar power right at the moment, but then we can run off the batteries when.
Yes,
when
fortunately
we have a
cloudy it stores,
day.
Doesn't it? So
yeah. So here we are at Writers' Voices, and we have some really interesting guests with us today.
And I have in my hand one of the most beautiful books.
Oh, thank
I
you.
I think I've ever seen and had the privilege to look at. And it's a actually co-authored, I guess you could say, by Stephen Schneider and Rivka Schneider. And one is a poet, the other an artist. And we'll start with Stephen Schneider, professor in the Department of English at the University of Texas, Pan American, where he also serves as director of new programs and special projects for the College of Arts and Humanities. He's a founding member of the South Texas Literary Coalition in the Rio Grande Valley and the recipient of two Big Read grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. He has used the Borderlines Drawing Border Lives traveling exhibit to promote the teaching of culturally relevant literature and creativity. This is very much in the right now, something we need to hear about, I think.
That's okay. True.
And the drawings, the poetry is fantastic. The drawings as well. And Rivka is one of the foremost artists of La Frontera, the binational region of the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas. Her artwork reflects the social and economic realities of the border while celebrating the local culture, people, and music. Rivka lives in McAllen, Texas with her poet husband, Stephen. Welcome to.
Well, thank you.
We're happy to be here.
Thank you. This is just a couple sentences of the many things there about you, but just to give a short introduction. But I'm serious when I say this is a magnificent book. It really is.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, this isn't your first time in Fairfield.
Oh no, we visit periodically, and.
And you lived here at one point.
Well, we like to come back to Iowa. You know, I went to school in Iowa City at the University of Iowa.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you in the writing workshop?
I was in the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Wow.
And I actually earned both my Master's of Fine Arts and my PhD from the University of Iowa. So our roots and our ties to Iowa go back many years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So were you in the poetry?
I was in the poetry workshop.
Poetry
in fact,
workshop.
I was recently interviewed by a reporter at the Iowa City Press Citizen about my years in the workshop. And of course, he was interested in our new book and told him that when I was in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, I was there with a couple of other students who went on to win the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, my goodness.
Rita Dove and Jory Graham both went on to win the Pulitzer Prize in poetry. So I say, you know, I'm waiting for my ship to come in. you know, it's always, we gave a reading back in on the 21st of July at Prairie Lights in Iowa City. And the Iowa City Press Citizen contacted us and was very interested in this new book, Borderlines, Drawing Border Lives, because it really addresses current issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Yeah.
And he thought it was unique in that it really makes a social statement through the poetry and the art, and was asking me about that and whether I had learned that at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And I told him, well, no, the Iowa Writers' Workshop is a big umbrella, and a lot depends on what you bring to it and what you do when you leave there. But so this interest has been fueled by our years on the South Texas border.
Well, what drew you to that part of the country?
Well, I went down there for a job. I went down there in 2001 to be the chair of the English department at the University of Texas, Pan American.
And you came there from, where were you?
My previous position was at the University of Nebraska at Kearney, near the Platte River. And moved into this position in 2001. And the University of Texas Pan American is the second largest Hispanic-serving institution in the United States.
Wow.
And we live about 10 or 12 miles from the Rio Grande. So it's a bicultural, binational area. And our book is really inspired by the people that we've met on both sides of the border.
Now, I'm guessing that even on the U.S. side of the border, there are many people with Hispanic heritage. Is
Absolutely.
About 95%.
Really? And I think people don't realize that. They think there's this line, and on one side it's Hispanic people, and on the other side it's not. And
well, I mean, the area of the border in Spanish La Frontera, it really... It's changing now because of the wall and because of all the pressures that are going on. But it really was kind of this ni aquí ni allá, neither here nor there place until you got up to where the border checkpoints were in Falfurrias, which is quite a bit north of us. I don't know how many miles.
60.
There's like, yeah, one in Falfurrias, and then there's one on the way to Corpus Christi. And that was kind of this place that people would cross and go through and have to, but in the valley, anything, everyone was kind of accepted.
But that's changing?
The whole situation, the border has been changing. We couldn't do this project now in the same way that we did when we came there in 2001. The situation with the violence from the drug cartels and the Mexican army on the border has just escalated the tension and the problems in the area. So we would cross over at Reynosa or Progreso. Reynosa is the city that's a large city that's just south of McAllen, like 1.5 million population. A lot of times we would go to Progreso. A lot of people go there, just walk across the bridge and shop and so on. And so there's a lot of street vendors and people that are in my book. And now you're taking your life in your hands to go there.
Oh.
There's, you know, kidnappings, there's battles in the street with the drug cartels and the army.
Well, why did you decide to write Border Lines, Drawing Border Lives, or maybe I should say publish it? You know, writing isn't exactly the term, but why did you decide to do this project?
Well, it actually evolved. I'm a figurative artist. And so when I first got to the Valley, I organized a group of artists, and we would have a model each week, and we'd just draw from the model. And there's one piece in the book, Rolando, from that time. But then I was seriously injured in a car accident, and I couldn't work for over a year. And when I started working again, I found it was easier to work from photographs because I could put them down, take them up as I felt up to working. And then, so then I could go out and take pictures of people living their lives all around us. And then Stephen wrote a poem about one of them. Well, he'll explain that this is the tradition of Ekphrasis that we actually had a previous poetry art exhibit. We call it poetry art, but there's this tradition of writing poetry about works of art. The poem
Ode
on a Grecian Urn by Keats is like one of the examples most people learn in school.
And what was the term that you used for that?
The term is ekphrasis. It's a classical Greek term used to describe writing about works of art. And since the Greeks and up through the Middle Ages and the Enlightenment and the Romantic period and the 20th century, poets have been very interested in art. And the technical and classical term used to describe their poetry about a work of art is called ekphrasis. So this is a collection of ekphrastic poems. Each poem is written in response to one of the drawings, one of the works of art that Rivka has done.
Now, is that that first one that you did, is it in the book?
Yes. I think it was Progreso Street Vendor.
Smiling
was the first one. And then, Monica, over the course of 3 or 4 years, I wrote several other poems about the 25 drawings that you find in the book. Rivka's actually done over 100, but we selected 25 for our book.
Now, that's a whole nother series of questions. How did you go about deciding which
ones?
Which
ones? He wrote about the ones that moved him. I would try to give a hint. I would take, you know, a finished piece, and, you know, if I wanted him to write about it, put in his study. But it was definitely that's his choice, because it's his, you know, his response to my work of art.
Well, what I really like about the poetry is that it touches the heart.
Well, thank you.
That's, to me, that's poetry. I mean, I don't enjoy reading poetry that I can't understand. Okay?
Well, it's interesting you mention that that point, because that was the very point that Jeffrey Carlson was making up in Iowa City in the Press Citizen the other day, is that so much of contemporary poetry is difficult to understand.
Inaccessible.
Sly allusions, inaccessibility. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he's saying, well, this book is refreshing.
Yeah, that's
because,
right.
Because, as you point out, it does touch the heart, and the work is accessible. And it's intended to be that way, because we really wanted to make the lives of the people we've encountered on the border come to life and express their aspirations and their dreams. It's a beautiful area. It's a shame now that there are these problems with the drug cartels, but the border itself, the border region itself, is a place where culture is exchanged, and up until recently, people could cross very freely over pedestrian bridges, which is what we oftentimes would do, where we met several of the subjects who are in our book.
What do you ever find, like, as you're writing a poem, if you have like a beautiful phrase in the poem, but it is hard to understand, you know, it doesn't carry a really clear meaning, do you run into that and think, okay, well, I have to do something to make this more understandable, or do you just naturally write in a way that's very accessible?
Well, you know, every writer does some of their most important work when they're revising their work. So word choice and selection is extremely important to me, and many of these poems went through several drafts. You know, accessibility, sometimes people think, oh, well, therefore it's simple or simplistic, and that's not the case at all. It takes a lot of craftsmanship to write a poem that touches people and yet is still accessible to them. One of the challenges in putting together the poems in this book is I wanted a variety of poems. I didn't want them to all sound alike.
Yeah.
And so I used a variety of forms, like the villanelle and the sonnet and the sestina. If you study those forms, they're actually very complex. There's certain rhyme schemes, there's certain patterns of meter and rhythm. Mm-hmm. And yet if they are accessible to the reader and I've met the expectations of form at the same time, then I'm very happy.
Well, now there's a whole nother level of complexity, though, because all of these poems have been translated into Spanish.
Right.
And was the translator able to maintain the poetic form in the translations?
Good question. You know, I worked with a poet who was also, at the time, a graduate student in the department that I was chairing. His name's Jose Antonio Rodriguez, and he's bilingual and from the border region. And early on, we talked about this very issue of translating the rhythm and the meter and the rhyme from English into Spanish. And he assured me that that would be his goal and objective, and would show me drafts of the translations. We would review them together. We would show them to other readers, bilingual readers. There's a colleague of mine named Jose Skinner, who is a very good translator himself. So we got lots of feedback on the translations, and one of the points that people have made is that the rhyme and the meter is translated very well. In fact, in one of the poems, the Decima poem, a few readers, including my wife, think it's more sonorous in Spanish than it is in English.
Well, and the Decima is the Spanish form.
Would you be willing to read both of the English and the Spanish version of that poem for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Let's do that.
Let me see if I can find it. And in the meantime,
do you speak Spanish fluently yourself?
I speak good Spanish.
How about you, Rivka?
I'm more kind of like Spanglish, Tex-Mex, like we do where we live, you know, because one person will be talking Spanish, the other talking English, whatever's more comfortable. We understand each other, and that's kind of how it goes.
That's cool. Now, did you know Spanish when you moved down there?
Just some, you know, like I learned in high school and so on. I haven't studied it to be perfectly fluent, but... That's how we all get along there.
Knowledge.
Yeah, I have a working knowledge, yeah.
Work in progress.
Yeah.
Okay, Stephen.
Okay, so this poem is called Decima, Unfulfilled Dreams. A decima is a Spanish form of 10 lines. It's a 10-line poem. So here we go in English. She carries bags on her shoulders, her dreams for this life unfulfilled, on streets where she walks without will. The hope for her future smolders. In her eyes, she looks much older. Now she longs for another world, a place where happiness unfurls, where her spirit is far lighter. In her heart, she's a fighter for a future bright like a pearl. So here it is in Spanish. Décima, sueños frustrados. Carga bolsas sobre sus hombros, sus sueños frustrados están sobre calles donde vaga sin voluntad. Arden sin llamas sus anhelos, su mirada muestra los años. Hoy otro mundo es lo que quiere, donde la alegría florece, donde su alma flota. Liguera, y en su pecho vive una guerrera por un mañana brillante.
This is a young woman. She's probably about, I guess, 12 or 13, and we met her and her family in the streets of Nuevo Progreso. And somehow we were talking to them about, you know, does she go to school? And their answer was, you know, she's... I think it was like 13. She's old enough to work. Uh-huh. But to me, in her eyes, I saw a desire for something more than that. And so that's what inspired this drawing and then this poem.
Now, Rivka, how did you get people to agree to be subjects of your portraits?
You asked them.
And you were doing it from photographs, so they didn't actually have to... hold real still and pose for hours.
There is one drawing, Rolando, that was from when I used to do them from life. Right. But as this project unfolded, I was doing them more from photographs. But we would get to know the people and talk to them in most instances. Sometimes it was a brief encounter. Like, for example, Proud Vendedor, you know, he was in the what they call a pulga, these open-air flea markets, in Mission, Texas. They're all over Texas, but that was the one that he was in. And we'd go there a lot and visit with him and talk with him and learn his story. You know, we'd kind of get to know the people, and then it would evolve into a drawing and a painting.
So you would ask if you could take their picture to make a drawing?
Oh, yeah.
And then when you finish the drawing, would you bring it back to show them, or do you...
Very transient community.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah. There was times like the woman Nessun Mantira was like, you know, bring it back and show it to me, and then I couldn't find her.
Oh.
You know, so as people come up to the border, they're usually looking for something. You know, they couldn't stay where they were, you know, for whatever financial reasons or whatever's pushing them off their land or so on. And so these are people that I'm just meeting on the street a lot of times. So
most of the people in the book haven't ever seen these portraits.
I don't think so.
And have you?
Some of them have.
Some people have, and it's some people have seen the work when it's been in the gallery. More the people from McAllen at Edinburgh and so on. They'll see it exhibited at the gallery at the university. But most of the people haven't. Oh yeah, like he's showing me. There's a painting of mariachi with a red violin. He's from the University of Texas Pan American Mariachi. They have three different groups. So he's seen that painting.
Mm-hmm.
This is more about giving a voice to the voiceless and a face to the faceless. Uh-huh. It evolved first to be a traveling exhibit that we were we traveled around South Texas.
Okay.
And then Wings Press of San Antonio, it's a very good small press. We encountered them at the Texas Book Festival, and he chose to publish this as a book. And it's actually, the cover is his design and so on.
Okay, so you didn't really conceive the project as a book.
No, it evolved.
Wow.
It evolved from my artwork, then he did the poetry.
And then you did an exhibit, and,
right,
and then it became...
Right,
and we've traveled it around.
The initial stage of development was the exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And we had four mica text panels made to match the size of the frames of the artwork. And on those text panels, we had silk screened the poems in English and Spanish. So that exhibit of the 25 drawings and 25 poems is housed in our library at the University of Texas Pan American, but it has traveled. It's gone to Rockport, to the Rockport Center of the Arts, to University of Texas, one of the community colleges, rather, in San Antonio. And we're in conversation with the University of Texas San Antonio about their hosting the exhibit at the Institute of Texas Cultures next year. So that it was a traveling exhibit before it became a book. And when we, at some point I think we realized, well, there's also a book here. And so as Rifkus...
So you went to the book fair to...
We went to the Texas Right. Book Festival in Austin, which is held each fall. Okay. And there we met Bryce Milligan, our publisher, and handed him a sample card with one of the drawings and a poem on it, the first piece, the six-year-old street vendor. And he loved it, and we shook hands right then and there at the book festival. And, 2 years later, we have a book. So he's done a marvelous job with the design of the book and also the printing of the book, which was done in Hong Kong. It's on a beautiful paper. And... he's planning to submit the book to some design contests for book design.
I can see why.
Yes, I can too. And think of the numbers of people that can see this. Well, they wouldn't be able to see the traveling exhibit.
Right, right. Sure, the book can go anywhere.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are Stephen and Rivka Schneider and their book, Borderlines, Drawing Border Lives.
Yes, and we're going to be giving a reading this Saturday night from the book at Revelations.
So that's July 31st. In case you're listening to this as a rebroadcast, you may have missed it, but if you're listening to us live, that'll be tomorrow, Saturday evening, Revelations at 8 p.m.
Right.
Right. Now, do you have any of the actual original portraits that you'll be displaying too? Do we get a mini exhibit or...
No, they're in South Texas. Yeah.
It's a long way from the border to Iowa.
Yeah.
But as your mother pointed out, people can see the drawings in the book.
They sure
but
can.
You know, they have been beautifully reproduced in the book. They really have.
Yeah, thank you. And, we work closely with the publisher to get the right images to him and, and reviewed proofs of the book because... It really is a visual book.
It is.
And it's unique. While there are other collections of ekphrasis, that is collections of poetry about works of art, there are not very many where the artwork is printed side by side with the poetry.
Really?
Yeah. So a lot of times you have to go to the web or to an art book to see the artwork that the poet has written about. You know, there are not many books like ours where you can actually see the artwork beside the poems.
See, this is really, really, I think, a marvelous way to do it. Because if you have to go somewhere else and find the artwork to look at, how many people are going to do that?
Yeah.
Right. Only the ekphrastic fanatics.
Right. Now, your publishing company has a unique mission. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the mission of Wings Press is to... first of all, to promote the writing of the Americas, meaning all of the Americas, without commercial consideration clouding the choice to publish or not to publish. You know, so much of publishing is dominated by
money,
by commercial considerations. And the nice thing about an independent press is that they can take a risk sometime, mm-hmm. and publish cutting edge kind of work like ours. Wings Press attempts to produce multicultural books that enlightens the human spirit and enlivens the mind. And if you've taken a look at their website, you'll see that there is a Southwest focus to the work that is published by Wings Press. There are a lot of Latino and Latina writers, some very important ones published by Wings Press. Not all, of course. And their mission is to produce books that are also environmentally produced, that is, treating the planet itself as a partner in the production of the book.
Wow. So really, your book was a perfect fit for them, wouldn't you say?
That was his estimation, and now we're going to be at the Texas Book Festival this October, just like 2 years later after we met him, and then we're going to be at the Miami Book Fair International. And there's been many excellent reviews in the different cities we've gone to, touring with our book this summer in San Antonio. The paper there was really taken with our book. And also one way that Steve's used it a lot is in education. And so, you know, they were saying in their editorial that they'd like to see it in the hands of bilingual classrooms on both sides of the border. Mm-hmm. And
for all ages.
For all ages, also. Yeah. Yeah. Also. And
see, that's the beauty of your poems. A child can understand this.
Right. And so we're discovering that the book has what they call crossover appeal, you know, to
limitless potential.
High school students, college students, young readers, adults.
Yeah.
You know, and the best poetry really does speak universally to people of all ages. And
true.
So, you know, I consider that to be a strength of the work. And of course, the images are also appealing individuals of all different
so
ages.
It's a book for poetry lovers, for art lovers, for political activists, for spiritual people, you know.
Yeah. It's a book from the heart.
Yeah.
To open the hearts of all the people who read it and see it.
Material.
Oh, well, you're very kind there, Caroline. That would be...
From your lips to the committee's ear.
The committee's ear.
There you go.
Well, you know, I taught English in high school, and so, you know, we read stuff that was difficult, and I would tell the kids now, especially American Lit, I say now, some of this stuff is really hard to understand, but you got to realize this is where we came from. This is our history.
Right.
And so just, you know, go with the flow, try to, you know, get something out if you can. And then I gave open book tests because it was difficult. But this is not difficult. This is, and this, like I said before, speaks to the heart. This is where it's at.
See, that's very interesting what you're saying, because an important aspect of Stephen's work with literacy along the border is to provide culturally relevant texts. Mm-hmm. That the students can see themselves in. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of why I did this project, because when people go to a museum and the artwork is of everybody but them, they can't relate to art as well. Right. But when they come and they see artwork and it's them, it's a whole different thing. And so we've been thanked everywhere we go, you know, for thank you for doing art about my, you know, my town of Progreso or my town of Mission, Texas, or, and so on.
Right. That's an interesting point and an important point, because it's like art from the Middle Ages, you know. Well, that was a long time ago, and things were different, and you know.
So by being culturally relevant at the same time, showing all these different forms of poetry, all of a sudden people say, "Oh, poetry is cool, mm-hmm. and I can read it," and then they start opening up to all kinds of experiences.
Yeah. How long did this project take from the first, from the very beginning until?
I started drawing, you know, within, you know, the group was with like within 2 weeks from when I moved there. So it's from 2001 to, you know, was just published in April.
And how did you maintain your motivation during that whole time to keep going?
To keep drawing?
Yeah, to keep drawing.
Well, that's a, it's kind of a serious question for me because, I mean, I have to draw. And so where I, if I'm either drawing the people where I am or I'm painting the landscape where I am and so on. But after I was injured, I was in severe pain. For excruciating pain for many years. I had a spinal cord injury and head injury and had to get surgery and all that stuff. And but there's something called pain gates, which if you distract yourself enough, kind of like they you don't notice your pain as much because you're focusing on other things. And so I would have to get myself up and start working, and then after a while, I wouldn't be in pain, or I wouldn't be feeling it the same way. And so it actually, in a way, kept me going. But like, if you look in, say, the eyes of like street beggar and daughter,
that's a lot of pain.
Yeah, and so
and that was your pain.
That was I was. It's like it all goes together. You know, it all. It's like I'm. I could express these people's pain because I was in pain. I could maybe understand it a little bit more. I could relate. I could see them. You know, a lot of people, especially from Mexico, when they would first see my art, they would say, "Oh, we see these people all the time, but we never saw them, but now they do." Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like that kept me going in a way. I was expressing it, and it was kind of my kind of protest for my pain. You know, why do people have to rear-end people, you know? and why are people living like this in a land of plenty? I mean, the border is described as this place where the third world bleeds against, the first world. And it's like that, and you don't understand. You cross the street, and all of a sudden, little children are begging, you know, and selling, you know, on the streets. It's such a different world. And so all those different things just make you keep on doing it. But then when I started feeling better, I started doing more of the musicians. And, and now my work, if you look on my website, is more colorful and so on.
More upbeat.
Yeah, it's more upbeat, yeah. Paint, you know, color.
There's happier.
Yeah, happier.
How, you know, when you're in an area like this where you are where you see and you are actually seeing the people in poverty, you're not just looking the other way, but you're actually seeing them, but you yourself are living a life of relative privilege, how do you deal with that?
Well, this is one way you deal with it, is you try to give everybody, you know, a voice to help people be heard, just express what you're experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, the book is
and also all your work with Stephen does so much work with educating in the area.
Right. I mean, we're really very actively involved in the community there. I've done a lot of community literacy work. Those grants from the National Endowment for the Arts are to promote reading in public schools and libraries throughout the Rio Grande Valley, because we do have low literacy rates among Hispanics nationally and in the valley. And reading is in decline just generally in our culture. So we applaud you in having a show about writing and reading. So anyway, one of the ways that we deal with the social issues of the border is through education. And our book is also an educational tool. It's been used with teachers to promote culturally relevant literature, to promote understanding of creativity, the relationship between art and poetry. And we feel that through our work, we've, as Rivka has said, given a voice and dignified the people along the border whose circumstances are worse than our own. And by sharing this work with others in Texas and now in Iowa, we were in New Mexico this summer, in New York, hopefully we're calling attention to their plight. You know, we're in the midst of a national debate on illegal immigration, and a lot of attention has been focused on the new anti-immigrant law in Arizona. which was recently, much of it has been overturned, at least temporarily, by a federal judge, as you know. Several of the reviewers of our book have said, you know, while this national debate is going on and raging, Borderlines, Growing Border Lives presents the humanity of the people of the border. And so that's our gift as artists, as a poet and as an artist, is to express and share that in our book. And we've gotten a great reception from the Latino community in Texas and nationally. Professor Norma Cantu at the University of Texas San Antonio, who is a professor of the border and of Latina studies, wrote the introduction to the book and praised us for the work that we're doing in trying to heal some of the wounds along the border. And other Mexican-American writers from Texas, Renee Saldana, Carmen Tafoya, Sandra Cisneros, who went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop around the time that I did, all have written glowing blurbs, as they're called, of our work. And that's been really important to us and meaningful to us, that we've struck an accord of authenticity. We're not tourists. We're not even extranjeros, you know, which is foreigners. This is our home. We've been there for a long time now, and it's been very nice to see the support of the Hispanic community for our work.
And if listeners want to see some what some of these people have said or written about you, they can see it on your website.
Correct? Yes. Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. Our website is simply poetry-art.com. We call ourselves Poetry Art because it's a synthesis. It's a partnership. And the book is very much a partnership between Rivka's work and my work.
Stephen, I was curious about when you select a painting that you want or a drawing that you want to write a poem about. Do you ever like write multiple poems about the same drawing?
It's interesting that you asked that question. It sounds like you're thinking as a writer. Are you a writer, Monica?
I might be.
Right. I thought so. That's a writer's question. Well, the answer is sometimes. Sometimes I will approach a painting or a drawing in different ways, in different forms. In fact, not for this book, but more recently, I thought it would be fun to take some newer drawings that Rivka has done of musicians and write maybe three or four different poems about the same drawing. For example, one could be a haiku. One could be a prose poem. One could be a longer lyric or narrative poem. And then putting them side by side with the drawing and then having the reader, you know, experience each of the different poems about the same drawing. Or perhaps in the end just selecting one which seems best. So that's a long-winded answer to say yes to your question.
Do you ever actually write in Spanish?
No. I've done some translations from Spanish into English. When I was a student at Syracuse University, I studied abroad in Madrid. And when I came back, I did some translation work. But I haven't gotten to the point where I'm writing in Spanish.
You say that like you might someday?
You never know. Es posible.
That is true. Now,
si se puede.
Rivka, you mentioned that you're going to be at the Texas Book Festival in Austin this autumn and I think a Miami Book Fair. What is the purpose of going to those and what do you do there?
Well, we're actually going to be in the Austin Art Museum. And so we'll have a you know, a large screen with some of the, you know, we'll be able to project some of the artwork and then do readings. But the book fairs are just wonderful times where people who love books get to meet the authors and, you know, and the best books that have that come out in the past year. It's really an exciting thing. In Austin, it's all held around the Capitol building. We'll actually be in the museum, but so you're actually, like, sitting in the Senate chamber or the, you know, like that, yeah, while you're listening to these incredible speakers.
And it's open to the public?
Yeah, yeah, it's all free for the public.
And is it all Texas books?
Oh no, it's all over the country.
Wow.
yeah, I mean, that's everybody.
Yeah, we've heard Carl Bernstein there and Jeffrey Toobin, you know, top political writers from Washington, D.C. Last year, the novelist Margaret Atwood, Canadian novelist, was there. We've seen Sherman Alexie. Really, you know, just some of the top writers in the country.
And you.
Well, we're very fortunate. We feel very fortunate to be invited this year to participate in the Texas Book Festival. And then in November, we're going to the Miami Book Fair International, which some say is the largest book fair. And, you know, you have to submit your book for review by a board in order to get accepted to the book fairs. It's not like open admission, as it were, open enrollment. There's a selection process. So this is further confirmation of the work that we've done, and it gives us an opportunity to travel and share it, you know, outside of the valley where we live.
At the Texas Book Fair in Austin, what they do is they have a whole schedule of times where the different authors will be giving a talk, or sometimes groups talking about a certain, you know, idea, you know, a panel talking about a certain idea. So you do have this special time where, you know, you get to just meet and listen, mm-hmm. you know, to the author. It's not just like tables or, you know, somebody sitting there, but it's actual time when they either give presentations or lectures.
And publishers must go there also, because that's where...
Yeah, then they have tents and tents of the publishers
and agents and...
All those kinds of things. Yeah, that's the time to connect.
Yeah, it's a good networking opportunity. Are you familiar with the work of Jane Smiley?
Of course, yeah.
Right, she wrote A Thousand Acres and Moo.
Right.
Both here in Iowa. You know, she was there last year, and you'd walk into an author's party and see people like that. So it's a good networking opportunity, and it's also a good opportunity for authors to sell their books, because after your session, there's a signing tent where the authors go to sign their books, and people are there from all over the state, but also from outside the state. So it's a very nice opportunity for writers.
Now, when you went there 2 years ago, were you specifically looking for a publisher at that point?
I think so. I think, we went to the festival just to enjoy the opportunity of seeing all these great authors
right.
and listening to them. But we also knew that, you know, a lot of presses would have their tables outside in the tents. And it's an opportunity to meet those editors and publishers. So most definitely.
Yeah, well, you also are very aware of Wings Press, because many of the writers that you've brought to the University of Texas Pan American for the Festiba, the Festival of Arts and Literature that he's the co-director of each year, were published by Wings Press. So he was very aware of Bryce's standing.
So that was your first choice as a publisher?
I thought it would be a good fit.
Yeah.
I thought it would be a good fit because of his Southwest focus and his interest in the border culture.
Now, many writers struggle to find a publisher
right.
to get published. It doesn't sound like you had much struggle.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm familiar with a lot of those stories, and it's not like I haven't... experienced some of that myself throughout my career, but we were very fortunate with this book to kind of just be in the right place at the right time with the right person on the same page, as it were, and it all worked out, you know, and it doesn't always happen that way, but this was a pretty seamless process.
I mean, Stephen has published about 5 books now.
Mm-hmm.
So he's had a lot of different experience.
So what else have you published?
Well, I have 2 other collections of poetry. One is called Unexpected Guests. It's actually published by First World here in Fairfield, Iowa. And then I did a chapbook of poems in Nebraska called Prairie Air Show. And several of those poems are coming out in an anthology. And then I'm also a critic. I have a PhD in American literature. So I've written quite a bit of criticism of contemporary poets. I've written two books on A.R. Ammons, both published by Fairleigh Dickinson University Press. One is a monograph, the other a collection of essays about Ammons' poetry. And then early on in my career, I worked in nonfiction and had a couple of books published in New York, nonfiction books. One's called Castles in the Sand. It's about building sandcastles at the beach. It was chosen as a new and noteworthy paperback by the New York Times. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And another book called The Athletic Eye. This book is really special to me because of the collaboration with my artist wife, Rivka.
Would you like to share another poem from the book?
Please.
Certainly. Do you have a request?
Mom?
No, they're all good.
You get to pick.
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, the page is open to Happy Bead Seller, and this is a drawing of a young boy outside La Fogata restaurant in Nuevo Progreso, which is one of the border towns near where we live. And this poem is written in the first person, so it's a monologue, a dramatic monologue. I stand with these beaded necklaces outside La Fogata each Saturday afternoon, laughing. I like to listen to the young children sitting on the curb with their accordions, playing in the sunlight for shiny dimes that tourists from El Otro Lado toss into paper cups. I am happy for no reason except that I am young, and I am here outside La Fogata on a busy street where my uncles cut hair in the peluqueria across from Noe's Cafe. And other kids sell silver bracelets and dive after empty Coke bottles. I hold these brown and white beaded necklaces in my hand and draped around my arm like priceless jewels discovered in the white sands of my dreams. I am only 10 years old, and I know that 10 is a lucky number, because I plan to have $10 by the end of the afternoon, $1 for each necklace I will sell, and one of those dollars for a raspberry raspa I will buy at Alyssa's, where my friends and I will meet when the sun sinks into the Rio Grande like an orange balloon falling from the sky. Now, you may notice in that poem that I slipped in a couple of Spanish words.
Mm-hmm. Otro lado.
El otro lado. That's one of the phrases in Spanish, which means
the other side.
The other side. Now, I suppose I could have written it in English, the tourist from the other side. But it's so much more interesting to say El otro lado. And along the border, we do have a lot of code switching that is moving back and forth between English and Spanish. So I wanted to capture that flavor.
It's much more musical.
It's more musical. You're absolutely right. And then instead of saying barbershop, I said peluqueria. Now, there isn't a glossary in this book. But that's intentional. Because I want readers, both English and Spanish, to learn new words, to learn the other language, as it were. And so the reader of English who is puzzled by peluqueria can easily type it in Google and find out what it means, and then they've got a new Spanish word. And Spanish has become really our second language, and is more and more important to know. So there are places in the book where I do use some Spanish words or phrases in the English language poems. And so far, I haven't gotten any complaints.
Now, what I'm curious about is, in the Spanish translation, are those words in English?
Well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, the one place in this particular poem, no. The translator translates it as el otro lado in Spanish.
Okay.
And same with peluquería. But one of the changes that we had to discuss was, you know, in English, the river that separates the two countries, Mexico and the United States, is referred to as the Rio Grande. But the Mexicans don't call it by the same name. Mm. They call it, do you know what they call it?
Is it like the Rio Bravo?
Very good. They call it Rio Bravo.
I think I read that on your website.
All right.
Well, see? We're educating.
That's right.
This is culturally relevant. So, in the Spanish versions of the poems, the river is referred to as Rio Bravo, whereas in the English language version of the poems, it's the Rio Grande.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Rio Bravo, does Bravo mean brave? Is that...
It means brave, it means great, it means strong. The river has all of those connotations.
Yeah.
For the Mexicans.
Interesting. Well, we only have a few more minutes. Rivka, I understand that some of these drawings and paintings have been published elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Okay, well, the last drawing in the book... Disappeared. Mass, well, the poems, the drawing's called Mass for the Disappeared.
And it's a very moving.
Well, that drawing was based, this is actually based on a photograph that an AP photographer had taken, and he gave me the photograph to work from, of a Mass for the Disappeared, a midnight Mass in Guatemala. And so this was published in a book called Towards the Literature of Hope. It's the Literature of Human Rights in Latin America, published by Yale University Press. And then right there. Mm-hmm. And then about four different drawings from the book were published in the journal, the Afro-Hispanic Review at Vanderbilt Press. So those are the publications before it was published in this book.
Now, an Afro-Hispanic Review, is that... What's Afro-Hispanic? Is it like...
Well, you know, in the Caribbean, you have a lot of Afro-Hispanic culture.
Oh, yes.
Because of the African slaves that were taken to the Dominican Republic and other islands in the Caribbean. And there was also a Spanish presence. So this particular journal at Vanderbilt is interested in that hybridity. And is interested generally in the border. The border itself is a hybrid culture. It may not necessarily be Afro-Hispanic, although we do have Afro-Hispanic influences in Mexico and the border. So the editor of the journal was just very taken by Rivka's drawings and decided to publish them in one of their issues.
And so how did he find out about them?
Well, we first met him at a conference. It was a conference about the Caribbean, right? At South Padre Island. It was sponsored by the Modern Language Department.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like Veracruz, there's certain areas in Mexico that, you know, have very much that, you know, Afro-Hispanic connection, and so that would be some of the drawings that he would choose.
We actually met the editor of that journal at a party for a New Yorican poet.
Oh, that's right.
For
Tato.
For a what?
A New
Yorican poet.
Tato La Vieira.
His name's Tato La Vieira. A New Yorican is somebody from Puerto Rico who has moved to New York.
Okay. All right. I did not know what that meant. Now I've learned two new things.
Yeah. And they have their whole kind of subculture there called New Yorican. So he's one of the founders of the New Yorican Poets Cafe. And his name's Tato La Vieira. He's a friend of ours, and a friend of his is the editor of the Vanderbilt Press Journal. His name's William Luis, and we met him in South Texas and showed him some of Rivka's work, and that's how it happened.
And everything's just so connected, because Tato was coming to South Texas to do work with the migrant students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just everything just kind of connects like that and interacts.
That's true. And you never know where where the next connection's going to lead you, do you?
Exactly. So that's the value of getting out there.
That's right. That's right. Well, we are unfortunately out of time, but I do want to remind our listeners once more about your reading tomorrow evening, July 31st, at Revelations Cafe in Fairfield at 8 p.m.
Right, and we'll be sharing our book and signing it afterwards for anybody who would like one.
And also, for more information, they can visit your website, poetry-art.com.
Right.
Right, and you can actually see some of the photographs, some of the drawings from the book, and also some drawings that aren't in the book or on that
right.
website.
A lot of Rivka's new work is on the website.
Yeah. So that can give people a little bit of taste of what they're in for if they come Saturday evening.
Taste of the Rio Grande Valley.
Taste of the Rio Grande.
Real bravo.
The Rio Bravo.
Real bravo. Well, thank you both very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. It really was.
And as we close, like we always do, we have a quote from Caroline.
Character is doing what's right when nobody's looking.
See you next week on Writer's Voices. And if you're listening on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Earth Wild. And if you're listening on Monday morning, please stay tuned for the Best of Broadway.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.
Programming is sponsored by crew listeners and the generous support of the Fairfield Volunteer Center, mobilizing and connecting volunteers to local nonprofit organizations and other community needs. With hundreds of registered volunteers offering their skills, talents, and interests to enhance the quality of life in the community, the center is welcoming new volunteers. Located in the Fairfield Public Library, the Fairfield Volunteer Center is open Monday through Friday, 12 to 4 p.m. The website is www.fairfieldvolunteercenter.org. And the phone number is 641-209-9045. That's the Fairfield Volunteer Center, where you make the difference.
This programming is sponsored by crew listeners and the generous support of Maharishi Ayurveda Products International, specializing in natural health solutions and holistic healthcare products, including Ayurveda herbal supplements, bath and body products,